You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode number 180 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
Oh, it's a sad pod. We are coming to you live from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 49 loser, Seattle Seahawks.
Hello.
Oh, it's Eeyore. Eeyore on the pod today.
It's the Steve Largent edition. Another Seahawk legend who never won a Super Bowl.
Well, yeah, that is true. It's also the Jerry Rice edition of the pod. So, yeah.
0-1 in playoff games.
It's funny because it's real.
But we do have some other things to talk about aside from being sad, which there'll be a lot of.
Obviously.
Well, actually, probably. The problem is we waited too long. We're going to pivot to rationalizing.
Oh, I'm already heavy in rationalizing.
You're heavy in the rationalized zone.
Yeah.
And in the life cycle of a football loss. But before then, we have an exciting beer that we're having here today.
We do have an exciting beer.
It might be Seattle football loss season, but it is also fresh hop season here in the Northwest.
I mean, we're kind of deep into fresh hop season.
I feel like they got these out a little bit late this year.
Today was the first time I had looked for them at Fred Meyer, but the first time that I'd seen them. Well, I guess I'd looked for them a while back and had not seen them. But now we have the Fremont Field to Ferment Fresh Hop Pale Ale. This is the Amarillo / Citra.
So hops? They used to do the hops separate, the fresh hops, and now they're smashing them all together, right? We've got two hops jam-packed into one can. When they say...
I was trying to figure out what the correct analogy of jamming
things
together was.
When they say pack it in, pack it out, they are not referring to hiking. They're referring to the hops in this can right here.
So I actually had a different fresh hop. This is not my first fresh hop beer of the year.
Wow. You're having fresh hops without me?
I am. I was a beer star in White Center the other day, enjoying the Little Big Mac from Little Woody's.
Mm, so trendy of you.
Fast food month. And let me look up here what beer I had. It was the Pike Brewing Dougie Fresh Hop.
Wow. Dougie Fresh?
Yeah. It's quite good.
Well, that is definitely a reference.
All right. Let's crack these open, though. We know that the Fremont Field to Ferment is going to be high quality. As it always is, and also because of the fact we've already each had one, at least one this evening. So a toast as we begin this pod to... So
Jason Myers.
It wasn't actually, even though you jinxed it by referencing it, that I was going to call it the biggest week in Seattle sports history. It wasn't all terrible because the Seattle Sounders got a win in the MLS Cup playoffs, and they got it on the foot and head, I guess, of Jordan Morris, who scored the first hat trick by a Sounders player ever in MLS Cup playoff action, as well as his first hat trick as a professional soccer
there
player.
We go.
So how about that, Jordan Morris?
All right.
The Mercer Island legend, the Seattle legend. Plenty more of that on that and previewing the MLS Cup semifinals to come. But unless we have any other toasts, and I don't think we do, it's time for the NBA Seattle Update, sponsored by our friends Pagliacci Pizza.
Because Pagliacci wants basketball back in Seattle, and so do we.
You know what else we want?
What is that?
To tailgate at Pagliacci when we arrive at the Huskies game much too late.
That was excellent. Excellent tailgating.
It was.
Right? That was A-plus tailgating, Pagliacci.
Yeah.
It was some of the best. I mean, the pepperoni slices.
Primo?
Incredible.
You're not going for that one?
What was that?
Primo?
Primo. I couldn't hear what you said. I was too busy making the mwah sound.
Oh, no. It's quite complex.
So we may not have a basketball team back in Seattle, but there are a number of players from Seattle spread throughout the NBA who are going to be watching for this year. So before we get to our list of 10 players for me to watch, our annual... This is the most fun thing that we do, right?
Yes. It's the most fun random tradition that involves backup point guards and
Aaron
European
Gomez
imports.
I feel like this might only be fun for us.
Quite possibly.
But we love it nonetheless. But before then, I feel like we should check in on some of the Seattle players who are going to be playing in this 2019-2020 NBA season, which begins tomorrow.
All right, so I haven't compiled a list of this, so I'm going to do it on the fly from my salary cap spreadsheet.
We know who we want to talk about. And
we don't want to talk about everyone. Do we want to talk about Joe Harris, Chelan's finest?
Sure. If you have anything to say about Chelan's finest, Joe Harris.
He won the three-point shootout last year.
this is your update for the 2019-20 season?
He's a starter on it. He's a starter on a playoff team.
That's why he gets paid as an analyst at ESPN.
It's a bit of a rough go for Marvin Williams, who's now coming off the bench for the Hornets. Jalen McDaniels, he got signed to a multi-year contract.
Jalen McDaniels?
Yes. It's Jaden's older brother who played at San Diego State.
Oh, well, good for him.
Yeah.
What team is he on?
Also on the Charlotte Hornets.
Maybe definitely going through players here.
Oh, yeah. I'm not joking at this. There's Kevin Porter.
Okay.
On the Cavaliers.
Uh-huh.
First round pick, last pick of the first round. We're going to have to skip through a few teams here, it seems like. You can feel free to fill here.
Well, I was going to...
Justin Holiday signed with the Pacers when he's reunited with his younger brother, Aaron Holiday.
I thought we were going to talk about the first-round draft picks from UW, but...
Oh, no. We already talked about Matisse Thybulle last week.
We need to talk more about Matisse Thybulle.
Everybody loves... Bill Simmons especially loves Matisse Thybulle.
Well, I want to talk more extensively about Matisse Thybulle. So, how many minutes... Let's say we're on the eve of the 2019-20 NBA season. How many minutes per game does Matisse Thybulle play for the Sixers this season?
So I bumped up his projection a little bit when I ran my final RPM projections to go on the site on Monday. Mm-hmm. But I still only have him at like 12 minutes a game. I mean, there's a lot of competition for playing time on the wing.
In Philadelphia.
And he is still a rookie.
How good of a defender is... What percentile does Matisse rank in the NBA as far as defenders as of this very moment?
I mean, that's hard to answer because we've never seen him in a regular season game. I have some questions about whether, you know, his tendency to rove will be exposed a little bit more when teams scout more than they do during the preseason. But
you're saying that teams will be able to take advantage of him drifting and trying to make big plays.
I think they'll try to do that in a way that they certainly didn't during the preseason.
Okay. And never did in his entire tenure in college.
Well, he was in his zone the last 2 years. And also, he's playing against college players who are not good at shooting or dribbling or passing or making decisions.
Wow, roasting college players.
Yeah, well, I'm about to have to start watching college
basketball. Okay, so follow-up question on Matisse Thybulle. Now that we have found out that Zion is going to be out for 6 to 8 weeks, how much money should we put down on Matisse as Rookie of the Year?
I mean, it's a good long shot play. I don't know what his odds are.
Will he be starting by the end of the season?
No, they have the strongest, like the deepest starting lineup in the NBA.
Ugh.
It is extremely unlikely that he will start barring injury.
Free Matisse!
Like,
okay.
Let's remain calm. Again, he still has not played a game that counts.
Okay, else do you have?
Jalen Noel.
Yeah, so what is our expectation for Jalen this season? Is he going to be playing?
No, probably not.
Okay.
They have way too many players on the wing already. They need to make some trades.
God, get a new angle.
Honesty, accuracy. That's not a. It's. I need a new angle besides that.
Okay.
I mean, I don't know. We'll see.
How many guards do the Magic have?
They do not have that many guards. So Markelle Fultz, didn't end up being a great preseason for him. He shot like 30% in the preseason.
But he attempted jump shots.
He did. They just didn't really so much go in the basket.
Do we think that this could be a slow burn type of season for Markelle?
I don't know what that means.
Where basically he needs time to develop to get back to NBA speed, but by like mid-season, all of a sudden we're like, wow, Markelle's really looking like a competent NBA player. And by the end of the year, you're like, oh, they're going into next year expecting him to be like a fringe all-star.
Fringe all-star? Like, I'll be excited if he plays the entire season. Like, my expectations for Markelle Fultz are really low.
Okay, a simple no would have sufficed.
Alonzo Trier kind of seems to be the odd man out of the rotation in New York. He doesn't seem very happy with it. So you got that going.
Were you expecting him to be happy with it?
No, I was not expecting that.
Okay, any other Seattle players that we should be keeping an eye on? Isaiah Thomas in a new home, will he be playing this year?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, they don't have John Wall. They've got Ish Smith and they've got him at point guard and then two undrafted rookies.
And Satoransky ain't walking through that door.
Satoransky is not walking through that door. He might have been he's probably graduated beyond. He was definitely on the players to watch list at some point. 100% he was. So he had thumb surgery before training camp and they thought he was going to miss the first week or two of the season. But Isaiah Thomas is ahead of schedule.
There we go.
It appears he's going to play on opening night.
Wow.
Not going to miss any time at all. He practiced on Monday.
Okay.
But the other Seattle player that we should talk about here is DeJounte Murray, who signed a four-year, $64 million contract extension with the Spurs before Monday's deadline for rookie extensions with incentives that can push it up to a total value of $70
million. So how has he looked coming back from injury?
I have not seen the Spurs play.
Okay.
His Comcast League Pass did not work during the entire preseason. So I was at the mercy of whatever they put on NBA TV or on
what,
national
TV. What
have
the reports been like?
I don't know. I don't know. I've seen a lot of reports on DeJounte Murray. His stats look pretty good. He's 3 of 5 on threes.
Really?
So that's encouraging.
DeJounte can shoot now.
Yeah.
He's been on the Spurs for a few years, so.
Yeah. You would expect it to happen at some point.
Any other players from Seattle? Marquise Chris did not make the Warriors.
He did.
He did?
Yeah. He's probably going to start at center for them on opening night. I don't know why I skipped past him. That's like one of the big stories in the preseason is Marquise Chris revitalized with the Warriors. There was a lot of trashing the Suns organization by Draymond Green where he conveniently left out that Marquise Chris played for the Rockets last year and alienated everyone in the Rockets organization.
Also played badly for the Suns. So you're saying Draymond was...
Draymond's saying that he was in a bad situation, and now that he's with us, he's going to his true colors are going to shine.
Wow!
Oh yeah, Draymond is like his hype man right now.
Really?
Oh yeah,
the Marquise Chris
openly campaigning for him to make the roster.
So what you said that it would have taken them like they were in a complicated situation cap room wise, or
yeah, they just waived Alphonso McKinney who came.
Oh, they waived Alphonso McKinney.
Yeah,
is he coming back?
No,
I thought they were expecting minutes from Alphonso McKinney.
Yeah, I mean, he went from their starting small forward at the start of training camp to being cut because that was the only
Marquise
guy.
Damn Chris forced him out.
Yes, he got claimed off waivers by Cleveland, so he is not coming back now.
All right, wow.
So we may have embarrassingly missed someone, but I don't know who that is right now.
I mean, this is an impressive...
Oh, Michael, do we count Michael Porter? We've talked about Michael Porter.
Oh, yeah, we should count Michael Porter. So what is our expectation for Michael Porter going into what is now his rookie year?
He scored a lot of points during the preseason, as you would expect, in a limited number of minutes. I don't know. What they're going to do at small forward remains to be seen. They've got, of course, an Hernan Gomez there. They've got Torrey Craig, who started in the playoffs last year against the Blazers. They've got Will Barton, who began last year as their starter and then kind of lost that job in the playoffs because he struggled. They've also got Malik Beasley, who may be the most talented of those players, but is not really a natural small
Michael
forward.
Michael Porter is the most talented of these players.
Yeah, I guess so. Malik Beasley may have had the best 2018-19 season of these players. Let's go with that.
Nuggets just, they have a lot of hardworking sort of 3-and-D wings, right? But as far as just talent-wise, Michael Porter
Jr. I would classify Will Barton as a hardworking 3-and-D wing.
What would you consider him?
I mean, he's pretty much a score-first player. He's like a classic, he's like a smaller Michael Porter, really. Maybe a little better defensively.
But there's a reason that people went in to Michael Porter's lone college season with the thought that he could have potentially been the first pick in the draft.
Yeah. Yeah, so we'll see if he can stay healthy.
And that never happened to Thrill Barton.
And that did not happen to Thrill Barton. All right, should we get up to our 10 players to watch?
Well, I just want to say that, I mean, so many NBA players from Seattle and the Northwest in general spread throughout the league, and also a testament to the Husky program, because we're really talking about
Husky
players.
Are we counting Nigel Williams-Goss, by the way?
Is he on a team?
He's on a team.
Oh, my God.
Utah Jazz.
Nigel Williams-Goss.
And Robert Franks, the first Wazoo player to come into the league in a while with the Charlotte Hornets on a two-way.
But we'll be talking about this more later. Could see maybe a couple more going to the NBA after this year.
Yeah.
All right. So...
So we're gonna play.
Can you intro the list again?
Yeah. So these are 10 obscure players that you wouldn't necessarily, you as a casual observer of NBA basketball wouldn't necessarily know, and we're gonna do this who he play for style, where you try to guess who these players play for.
Always.
All right. We start out the list with perhaps a familiar name, but maybe someone you haven't thought about in a while, and that is Bruno Caboclo. aka the Brazilian Kevin Durant.
Bruno Caboclo, huh? Is he on the Spurs?
No.
What team is he on?
The Memphis Grizzlies. So he is no longer 2 years away from being 2 years away. I think that was actually last year where he was just there. And he was in the G League most of the season, but the Grizzlies called him up late in the year, and he actually played pretty well for them. Made the roster this year with a non-guaranteed contract and should get rotation minutes for them as, you know, kind of a stretch four option.
Wow. This is the thrilling NBA preview that you were waiting for.
All right, next up.
Okay.
Vlatko Kanchar.
I didn't know. The Bulls?
No, the Denver Nuggets. This is the Denver Nuggets international player that we are obligated to have. I'm sure we had Jokic on this list back in the day. He is also technically a small forward for the Nuggets, but I just listed like the five guys who might play there, and he's not one of them. So he's not actually going to play this year. I just put him on here because I felt obligated to put a Nugget.
Is he a talented player?
He's got some skills.
You've lost your way with this list. You've gone from Jokic all the way down to Vlatko Kanchar.
We pretty quickly made that transition, if we're being honest. All right, next up on the list.
Yes.
This one you should get. Alex Caruso. Oh.
He's on the Blazers?
No. Oh. He's on the Lakers.
Oh. I think I did know that deep down somewhere.
And he's their best point guard. No. They're not going to play him over Rajon Rondo, obviously, and maybe not even over the likes of Quinn Cook as a backup, but Caruso is their best point guard. And also, he leads the league in the over-under for being called sneaky athletic this season, mm-hmm. because he looks like a middle-aged man, is balding, and is very good at completing lob dunks.
Oh, really?
Yeah, specializes in that.
In completing lob dunks.
He's dunking.
He's dunking?
He's dunking. Yeah, it's great.
So we're going to get some LeBron to Alex Caruso action this year?
Yeah, watch for that. If he's on the court at the start of the second quarter, that'll be like Frank Vogel's go-to call at the start of the second quarter, isn't LeBron lob dunk for Alex Caruso. Oh, last year was Lonzo on the receiving end of those. Now it's Caruso. All right, next up on the list, Luke Kornet.
Is he on the Timberwolves?
No, he's on the Chicago Bulls.
Oh, I was going to maybe guess that one. I knew there would be a bull in here somewhere.
After the Knicks signed like 12 power forwards, they had to let Luke Kornet go. But with the new measurements that the NBA is doing, the accurate measurements, measured in at 7'2".
Really?
And is a three-point specialist.
Really?
One of the tallest, you know, among these seven-footers who have made 100 three-pointers in a season. And they're sometimes playing him together with Lauri Markkanen, who is another seven-footer who shoots threes.
So they are spreading the floor in Chicago. Yeah. How's Wendell Carter? Is he any good?
We'll see.
Okay.
All right, next up on the list, a person who I said, oh, this is the kind of person this list is made for, and that is Niccolò Melli. Italian legend Niccolò Melli plays for the New Orleans Pelicans. Oh,
there we go.
Where he will get a chance to play some more with Zion Williamson's unfortunate injury to start the season and his knee surgery. They're going to start Brandon Ingram, it looks like, at power forward, go to small ball with a starting lineup, but Melli will play a lot. He's another stretch 4, 6'9", 6'10". About two-thirds of his shots in the preseason were threes. So, you know, he'll get some looks.
He played in Italy?
Yeah, I think he came from Italy.
How old is he?
Is
he young or is
mid
he
to
like...
late 20s? Okay. No, he's not young. Okay. He's not like
Sabonis age or something.
No, he's a veteran international player. So they really were good in the preseason when they played him and Zion together. Watch out for that when Zion does come back.
Does Zion stretch the floor there? Or is he playing inside with Melli outside?
Yes.
Oh, I kind of.
So
like
he's
that.
Effective. He's the five in those lineups. Yeah, those are good lineups.
Is this something that we're seeing throughout the NBA more, is even more this year than, obviously the trend is to having your big men stretch the floor, but is this something that's been even more magnified this preseason?
Well, teams are shooting way more threes. Three-point rate is way up. I would say that teams are going like two opposite directions because there's a lot of teams that are back to playing two traditional big men, including the Blazers. I mean, not necessarily traditional, but like two big guys. The Blazers are playing Zach Collins and Hassan Whiteside together as their starting lineup.
Really?
And then you've got other teams that are playing super small, like the Jazz, who are playing Royce O'Neal at power forward. He's like 6'6", 6'7". So it's going to make for some interesting matchups around the league.
And in general, threes are way up again.
Yes.
Which already, every year they're breaking records for amount of 3 points attempted.
Yes.
And they're way up.
Way up. Zach Cram had a nice piece on The Ringer about that.
So we're going to see tons of threes this year.
Yep.
Okay.
All right, next up on the list, Kendrick Nunn.
Kendrick. I feel like you've gotten even more obscure. I'm going to guess he's on the Knicks.
He is on the Miami Heat, and he scored 40 points in their preseason finale last Friday. Was outdueled by the 44 from James Harden in that one, but he's like a big-time shooter off the dribble, undersized shot creator, and has been playing in preseason ahead of Dion Waiters, who was so happy about that that he got suspended one game for conduct detrimental to the team.
What happened with that? Was he throwing soup? What happened?
I don't know. I
no one knows what the deal was.
I'm sure some people do. I don't.
It's not publicly known what the deal is.
Not that I've seen.
And where is Kendrick Nunn from?
He is from Oakland University.
Oh, in Michigan.
Yes.
All right. There, I guessed one thing, right?
Yes. All right. Next up, Eric Paschal.
I have no idea.
Golden State Warriors.
Okay. I'm guessing he was a rookie.
He is a rookie out of Villanova, second round pick. And he's one of the players that stands to benefit from them waiving Alphonso McKinney. Glenn Robinson III is set to start for the Warriors at small forward, which is a sentence to say.
Alongside Marquese Chriss?
Yes.
Their starting lineup is going to be D'Angelo, Steph,
Three all-stars.
And then this person who you just said.
Well, Glenn Robinson.
Oh, no, Glenn Robinson III and Marquese Chriss.
No, not Paschal isn't set to start, but he played pretty well during the preseason. He'll get a lot of minutes. I wouldn't be stunned if he ends up starting.
That is really some kind of starting lineup.
It sure is. All right, next up, PJ Washington.
Oh, PJ Toronto?
Nah, Charlotte. Where he's the person, well, not he's actually not
He was a first-round draft pick this year, right?
He is, yeah. He was a lottery pick. So he's kind of the most prominent draft pick of this group. But he has bumped Marvin Williams out of the starting five. I mean, I guess he hasn't because Marvin Williams is already not starting, but he started late in the preseason. Looked pretty good for a rookie, so. They're committing to the youth movement in Charlotte after losing Kemba Walker. Next up, Robert Williams.
Oh, man, I remember Robert Williams. Is he on the Kings?
The Boston Celtics. Where he's their best defensive center now after they lost Al Horford and Wazoo product Aaron Baines. He had a really weak preseason after everybody was excited about his chances of a breakout campaign. But, you know, because of the fact that Enes Kanter is defensively limited and so are Boston's other center options, they kind of really need Robert Williams to step up. So hoping he can do that. All right, lastly, Christian Wood. You don't want a 30 chance.
He's on the Rockets.
The Detroit Pistons.
Christian Wood.
Or he beat out Joe Johnson for a roster spot. Everyone really? Assumed that Joe Johnson was going to make it fresh off his MVP performance in the Big Three. But they could not clear a spot for both him and Christian Wood, who was excellent in the preseason, put up huge numbers at the end of last year as a starter in New Orleans. And someone who's always put up really good numbers, always been a favorite of Stat Geeks, but has never really found a home. And maybe this is
the
time.
He was a starter in New Orleans last year?
Did you like the last 10 games of the season?
Christian Wood?
Yeah. I don't know if you were watching a lot of Pels basketball at that point. Guess who was?
This guy. What? So do you want to run through those names one more time for anybody? You're going to put this in the show notes, right?
Sure. Bruno Caboclo, Vlatko Kanchar, Alex Caruso, Luke Kornet, Nicolo Melli, Kendrick Nunn, Eric Paschal, PJ Washington, Robert Williams, and Christian Wood. Oh, by the way, the other thing on Eric Paschal, the only NBA player that I have ever seen at, what's the name of the chicken place in Chicago? Well, I saw him there getting chicken.
Any chicken place in Chicago?
Yeah.
Is this something I should know?
I think it's Harold's.
Harold's?
Harold's Chicken Shack.
All right. Well, that's an important fact.
It is. It definitely helps your chances of making this list. That or being in Hernan Gomez.
I guess, finally, beyond these players, have there been any rookies that we should be paying attention to or would everybody be in that list? PJ Washington?
I mean, Tyler Hero is someone I considered. He's shot like 52% on threes during the preseason. Everyone's very excited.
He's on the Suns?
He's on the Miami Heat.
Or the Heat was my next guess.
Yeah. He knew it was someplace warm.
Yeah.
Someone with a team name that is related to
temperature.
Yeah. I don't think that's going to carry over during the regular season, but if it does, then that'll certainly be notable.
Okay. And then also, what about the Blazers? So you run projections every year.
And every year, the Blazers projection comes out terrible.
Uh-huh.
And fans get upset on Blazers' edge.
Uh-huh.
And this year? And then they just win 50 games.
And this year?
Their average projection is 8th in the Western Conference, 41 wins.
Stats are the real haters. Why is it that the Blazers always have such bad projections and always exceed these projections?
So part of the reason is because of the fact that they typically have abnormally good health the last few years. I mean, obviously they had the Nurkic injury, but that was late in the regular season. It didn't affect their record that much. So that's one factor. If you look at like actual minutes, they don't tend to outperform their projections nearly as much if you do it that, you know, kind of retrodict it that way. I mean, obviously the coaching of Terry Stotts and their ability to get more out of, you know, young players develop and then bring guys in and get more out of them is a big factor in it as well. That's going to be really important for them this season because, you know, they've lost key pieces of last year's team in Al-Farouq Aminu, in Maurice Harkless, and then also Nurkic, who's not going to be back until, you know, late in the season in all likelihood. So it's going to be on them to, you know, Hassan Whiteside's got to be productive. Rodney Hood's got to be effective in a larger role than he's played in recent seasons, including last year in the playoffs. And then some of these guys have either, you know, the young players that we've talked about, Anfernee Simons, Zach Collins, have got to either step up or they've got to get more than we expect from players who, you know, came in on the cheap. Mario Hezonja had a really strong preseason. I'm very excited for
Such a Blazers player. You know Hezonja is going to be good.
I mean, I just hope it's like, I can totally see it being like Stauskas last year where he had that huge opening night game and everyone's like, wow, we found such a player. And then that was like his best game of the season by far.
He is going to be a legend in Portland, Hezonja. They're going to love him.
Real good shot at it. He's wearing the Drazen Petrovic's number to honor his Croatian countryman.
Wow. Oh my God.
Yeah.
He better play well. The people of Portland need this.
I don't know if they do need this. They did go to the conference finals last year, but they want it.
They want it bad. They've been desperate for a player like Mario Hezonja to get by. So your projections have them 8th in the West. If you had to sort of take a less...
I'll do subjective predictions tomorrow, assuming I can find the time. I would probably put them... I guess I would put them 6 right now because I'm kind of skeptical of the Warriors at this point. And related to that conversation about how Glenn Robinson the third Marquise Chris has started this.
Just wait till Marquise Chris is an all-star.
Oh boy.
Also then finally on the Blazers, if a player was going to break out from the young players,
Anthony Simons.
Over Zach Collins.
Yeah. I think so. I mean, Zach Collins is going to have more opportunities, but in terms of like just sheer raw improvement, Simons. Like one of the things I did, when I was going through and making my most improved player pick, is I looked at like in the Shaney player projections I do, which player improved their combined points, rebounds, and assists the most in those projections over what they did last season, and Anthony Simons was number one on the list.
Really?
Now, as it turns out, that has nothing to do with winning most improved player. Because it's usually someone who's already a rotation player and then becomes like a kind of a star. So I picked Donovan Mitchell because of that.
To win most improved player?
Yep.
Donovan Mitchell?
Yep. I mean, that's usually what happens.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, I guess every once in a while you have like the Pascal Siakam situation where he really was a fringe starter and then, you know, a borderline all-star. But oftentimes it's guys who make that leap from like decent starter to really good.
All right. I'm kind of surprised by that one.
Yep.
All right. Well, looking forward to this NBA season, as always, when it starts in February. there's some thrilling things to pay attention to early in the season. That Zion's injured.
But... as a lifelong Blazers fan, I'm sure you'll be paying close attention. Let's talk about the NHL to Seattle. NHL Seattle begins seat selection last week, starting with club seats. Those club seats, they announced, will run between $285 to $355 per game and are being sold. It's actually less than the Vegas club seats.
Oh my God. Hockey tickets are insanely expensive, right?
In
general.
Yeah, they're quite expensive. Are being sold for a term of 3, 5, or 7 years. You got to commit to where the club states. The team also said that the cheapest season tickets will be $50 a game, with single game tickets available starting at $20.
All right.
I mean, can I get off a rant a little bit? This has nothing to do with NHL Seattle.
Okay.
But I mean, it does, but it's not a complaint about NHL Seattle. It's a complaint about other people. Everyone complains about the cost of NBA tickets all the time. And like, the league mandates that you have to have a certain number of $10 tickets for games. Like, the cheapest ticket to get in the door at an NBA game is actually cheaper than the cheapest ticket at a lot of other sports that that don't have the high-end ticket prices of the NBA. And it's weird to me because sports are the only place where you talk about the affordability of something based on the most expensive seats and not the cheapest seats. So that's my ticket rant.
Why are tickets to hockey so expensive?
People like attending it in person.
It doesn't translate
as well on TV,
right?
I guess.
Because popularity-wise, hockey is a distant number four.
But the diehard fans, like, the people who like hockey love hockey. It's just that there's not as many casual hockey fans.
Are there enough of those people? Obviously, there are enough of those people in the city of Seattle now.
We've seen the season ticket numbers.
Are there enough of those people throughout North America
for the league to survive? Yeah, I think they'll be okay.
Or to warrant ticket prices being...
Well, I've not seen NHL games and seen like 2,000 fans there, so I assume so. I assume their tickets are priced rationally.
It's pretty wild, right? I mean, like, for the Mariners would have, like, baseball typically.
Yeah, but you can't compare baseball.
But no, I'm saying that their low-end ticket price is basically the same as the NBA's.
Right.
I mean, obviously, they have a lot more of those. They're much more attainable than they would be for a good NBA team, but, like...
Yeah, the capacity is pretty substantial.
I mean, just the quantity of games. But I agree with you.
Let's continue.
I mean, it's also, just even thinking about this, kind of wild that, like, my Seahawks season tickets are not that much more expensive than these hockey season tickets, the cheapest hockey season tickets, where it's like... I'm paying for 10 games a year, and you're talking about paying for 40 games at that price. Like, that 40 games at $50 a game is math amount of money. $8,000?
What?
No.
How did you get $8,000 out of that?
Like, $4,000?
$2,000.
There we go.
I mean, it's slightly more than that because you got to pay for the preseason. It's 41.
I was thinking of if you had four tickets together.
Oh, of course. You didn't specify that, but of course.
It's still, that is an investment.
Yeah. Let's get back to the Seattle Sounders, who had that aforementioned 4-3 win after extra time in the MLS Cup opening round on Saturday against FC Dallas. A wild match saw the Sounders take leads of 2-0 and 3-2, only to give them up both times. A familiar storyline for the Sounders at home this season, although we were hoping it would be a little different with Roman Torres on the back line. It was Morris's third and final goal in the 113th minute that gave the Sounders the deserved victory and the trip to the conference semifinals for the 11th consecutive year, which is every year that they have played MLS soccer.
Insane.
I had to think about it because I assumed at some point they had lost in like a play-in game, but no, they never have. I mean, for a lot of that, there only were four playoff teams. In each conference, you automatically got to the conference titles, but semifinals, but still quite an impressive streak.
Absolutely.
So the Sounders in this match dominated the shot-based expected goal metric, according to 538 Soccer Power Index, with 4.0 shot-based expected goals to 1.8 for Dallas. Teams were even in terms of non-shot expected goals, 2.4 apiece, which, you know, reflect possession and kind of the flow of the match. But either way, probably a bit unlucky to give up three goals in this match.
I mean, this is what single elimination soccer does. This is why it's fun. This is why more soccer matches should be single elimination soccer, because it forces these teams to play soccer.
What if all soccer matches were single elimination soccer? What? They could do that?
I mean, most places, once you get to the playoff rounds, are single elimination, right? Or you're saying...
Well, in international tournaments, yes. Most places don't have playoffs. I don't know if you're aware of this.
But international tournaments, once you get past the group stages, they're single elimination games, and they're a lot more fun.
Yeah. Not every match produced that kind of fireworks. There was also a 4-3 match earlier Monday night before we recorded, Philadelphia beating the New York Red Bulls 4-3. But in less exciting, less thrilling matchups, I guess every game but one had at least three goals. So that is pretty good results for the MLS Cup playoffs. Atlanta 1-0 over New England, the only low-scoring matchup of the six in the first round. So the Sounders' opponent in those semifinals that they'll host on Wednesday night at 7 p.m. is Real Salt Lake, which got a 2-1 win over the rival Portland Timbers, avoiding a derby matchup between the Sounders and the Timbers in the playoffs once again.
We didn't want nothing to do with that one.
No, we wanted no part of that one. None whatsoever. Partially because of the fact that it's good news for the Sounders. Real Salt Lake, the weakest remaining team by Soccer Power Index. Unfortunately, the Sounders are the second weakest team. It was an interesting match. I watched the second half of this one. RSL dominated the first half. Seemed like they probably should have been up more than 1-0. Portland did not have a single shot in the first half, but then came out of the locker room and had the better of play in the second half, got the equalizer shortly after halftime, and it kind of looked like Portland, like RSL, was hanging on for much of the second half and just trying to get to extra time. But then they got the winning goal in the 87th minute from Jefferson Savarino to get the victory. Despite Portland having a slight advantage in expected goals. Looking at the regular season matchups between these two teams, the Sounders beat RSL 1-0 at home in April behind a Nicola Lodero goal, but lost 3-0 midweek in August in Utah, which was probably the low point of the Sounders' season. Since then, they have gone 6-2-2 to claim the number two seed in the West and then advance in the playoffs. Salt Lake boasts a balanced scoring attack with three different players, Severino, Albert Rusnak, and Sam Johnson, scoring at least 9 goals this season. And then defensively, still have stalwarts Kyle Beckerman as a defensive midfielder, and Nick Raimondo, the legendary goalkeeper.
Does Kyle Beckerman still have the white dreadlocks?
He does not. Okay. He's shaved them off. He's got short hair now. It's very disappointing.
I think that's probably a good decision by Kyle Beckerman.
Probably, but it's still disappointing.
Given all available evidence, I think it was the wise decision to shave off his white dreads.
So those are the two remaining players from when Real Salt Lake won MLS Cup at CenturyLink Field in 2009 on penalties over the LA Galaxy in a match we attended.
You just wanted to mention that because we were there.
No, I mean,
Do you think Mrs. Fantasy Genius Remember is going to that game?
I know she's going to chime in on this one.
Do you remember going to the MLS Cup in 2009?
In the rain, the Sunday after Thanksgiving.
Oh, that was a yes.
Okay.
It was Sunday, November 22nd, if I recall correctly.
Well, that wouldn't be after Thanksgiving, would it?
Thanksgiving can be whenever you want.
No, that's not Thanksgiving. It's in our hearts. Raimondo, maybe the greatest goalkeeper in MLS history in terms of his career, announced his retirement at the end of the season. He announced that before the season. So this could be his final. We hope it will be his final MLS match.
November 22nd, 2009.
Oh, I guess it must have been before Thanksgiving, but it must have been when we had the family Thanksgiving the week before.
Well, look who can remember things now.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
Thanksgiving is in our hearts. What does Soccer Power Index have as the percentage chance of victory in this one?
70% chance of victory.
The Sounders are winning this game.
I mean, anything can happen in a single game playoff match. That's what is you espoused the value of that earlier, but they are comfortably favored in this one.
It's going to be Wednesday night. This crowd's going to be hyped. They're playing against a pretty poor opponent. I mean, realistically, whomever is playing this game to get thrashed in the next round. So, but you got to play to win.
Yeah. You can't pull an upset if you don't get in the game in the first place.
I mean, like the famous Cousin Katie said after the Huskies lost to Oregon, we're buying lottery tickets because you need something to make yourself feel better and you got to play to win.
This really was the high point of the weekend by a wide margin. It's worth noting.
I had Manu's Tacos on Sunday.
Wait, did you?
Which I would say pretty high point of the weekend.
Yeah.
I thought that was pretty excellent. Also, I didn't coach in it, but Luca's flag football team is... They're not undefeated. They're undefeated since I took over as coach.
Did you take over as coach?
Ish.
Okay.
Since Hugh Jackson was fired.
It was a highlight, though. That redeemed football this weekend.
I mean, he threw a touchdown pass on a flea flicker that I drew up. So most importantly, that I would say that was the high point of the weekend for me.
You were much more excited about the fact that you drew up the play than the fact that he threw the touchdown.
It was drawn up. Look, what is more exciting? An exciting play on the field, if somebody makes a great physical play, that's fun. But drawing up a perfectly executed play and then seeing it be perfectly executed, that's the most thrilling thing about football.
It's you know what I say about...
It's what every dad dreams of when they have a child, is to draw up an excellent flag football play and then have their child be able to adequately execute it.
You know what I say about first and second grade flag football? It's really about the parents, not about the kids.
It's about the play calling. The scheming is what it's about.
Oh, boy. So back to this.
Anyway, if anybody from the Denver Broncos flag football team is listening to this, we're not running that one next week. It's going to be a whole new playbook.
It will be a short turnaround for both of these teams. Both of them played on Saturday before this match, again, midweek on Wednesday. The Sounders obviously had the extra 30 minutes, so that's not great. But, you know, the Royal Salt Lake had to play later in the day and will have to travel, so that evens it up a little bit.
I think you're splitting hairs here.
So the Sounders should win, but they may not win. That's my analysis.
Wow. You've really broken down sports
for us.
That's
what you come here for. Also,
Bruno Caboclo may break out and he may not break out.
It's always 50-50. Also in soccer action this weekend, playoff action this weekend, Reign FC suffered a 4-1 loss after extra time in the NWSL semifinals Sunday at the North Carolina Courage. The Reign scored the equalizer through substitute Ifeoma Onomano in the 93rd minute. The Courage then dominated extra time, getting 3 goals in that span. The Reign FC was outshot 34-7. In this match with 14 shots on goal
Jesus
from the Courage.
Christ.
Looking at the box score, I didn't
watch.
Was
Rapinoe playing in this match?
Yeah. Yeah, she played the entire match.
She just can't play every position?
Yeah, she's not.
There are 11 Rapinoes.
It reminded me a little bit, the box score of the U.S. game against Belgium in the World Cup in Brazil, where Tim Howard had like save after save, and the game stayed, I think it was scoreless in that one, despite the fact that the U.S. couldn't do nothing offensively. Maybe not quite that extreme.
It reminded me of that how, because in this game, the Reign lost 4-1.
Well, but they were 1-1 going into extra time.
Oh, okay.
So they kept it close, and then eventually the dam burst. So now we wait to hear whether Reign FC coach Vlatko Andonovski will be the next manager of the U.S. Women's National Team. This has been rumored, as we've discussed on this pod. And looking ahead to the 2020 season, that also will be interrupted by international play. Next year, the USWNT will play in
victory
the Olympics.
Victory tour, baby.
I mean, we'll see how long the victory tour goes on. Could be throughout the entire 2020 regular season.
They should just delay the NWSL season and have only victory tour. They should just make the whole season out of the victory tour.
It would probably be more profitable, if we're being honest. You know, men's basketball. The AP poll came out on Monday. The Huskies were not ranked, but tops among teams also receiving
votes.
So
I was reading your notes about this, and I thought this was about the Husky football team.
No, they're not tops.
And I was like, wow, they really are giving a lot of credit to Oregon. And then your next note was that Oregon is ranked number 15. And I'm like, man, I feel like they should be higher than that.
You didn't know anything about the fact that Arizona was the other team that was ranked in the Pac-12?
Oh, I didn't get there.
They are 21st. Colorado is right behind UW in the also receiving votes category, with USC, the other Pac-12 team that received votes. Now, a contrasting projection from third Pelton brother Ken Pomeroy at kenpom.com. His projections for the 2019-20 season came out on Monday and have UW 52nd overall entering the season and 5th in the Pac-12 behind Arizona, Oregon, Colorado, and USC.
And stats are the real haters.
Why do statistical projections hate all Northwest basketball teams? The Ken Palm projections have an average finish for the Huskies of 11-7 in Pac-12 play and 20-9 overall. Pending the additional 2 games, they will play in the Diamond Head Classic, which depend on who the result of their opening game.
So how accurately, given that this is one of the youngest teams in the Pac-12, basically returning nobody, returning very few players that have much of any in-game experience, how much are KenPom stats able to really recognize the incoming freshmen?
I mean, they account for that. Like, there's a bonus for your highly recruited players. So the Huskies are getting credit for it. I mean, I don't know that I've looked at, you know, how well he projects teams that have this much turnover as opposed to teams that are more consistent from year to year.
I mean, I would anticipate that teams with this much turnover are fucking terrible.
Yeah, really, they are. That's a reason, yes.
I mean, this is what we said. We argued about this like 6 months ago, right? And I was really down on the Husky basketball team this year. And you were like, no, they have so much talent, right?
I took a positive position on UW men's basketball.
You don't remember this when you're like, you're being overly negative?
I think you probably were
being that was the episode where I said Schmetz was getting fired.
What a classic episode.
Mariners were making playoffs. Edgar was missing out on the Hall of Fame. And the Husky basketball team was going to be terrible. But it seems like it would be very difficult to project. However, if you're projecting teams with very little experience, I'm sure in the history of time, they're probably not that good.
Yeah. I also think even if UW ends up the 52nd best team in the country, probably that will be good enough for them to make the NCAA tournament, even though logically you shouldn't, based on the number of automatic berths to teams that wouldn't make it otherwise. That wouldn't rank in the top 52 that take up spots in the 68. But just because of the fact that they'd be above 500 in a power conference,
yes,
have 20 wins plus, whatever ones they pick up in the Diamond Head in the Pac-12 tournament.
Luca, is that you? Do you want to come over here and talk us through the flea flicker that you ran at the end of your flag football game? Wow. That did not go as anticipated.
Again, a simple no would have sufficed.
His midnight terror did not want to. So I've drawn out the play over here, and I wanted him to walk us through it. No. Speaking of night terrors,
man, I wanted to note that the Huskies play an exhibition game next week, but that is a great transition to talking about losing to Oregon. Oh, that was a double Tristan Kevin slide.
Oh my God.
A 35-31 loss at home for the Huskies on Saturday. Their second loss at Husky Stadium this season after losing just one home game in the previous 3 years. It's not been great. I mean, here's the thing is the Huskies actually, they played well on Saturday. Like, if you look at the overall result, there was a 3-point spread. Oregon, we knew, was a better team. The Huskies had home field that made up some of it, but this was basically actually how it should have gone. And yet, because of the fact that they led by 2 touchdowns in the third quarter, it feels like a devastating defeat.
It is a devastating defeat.
Also, because of the fact that we had to see Oregon fans celebrate in Seattle again. It's just really rough. Like, we got there a little late, and I walk in.
We didn't get there that late. Weren't you there for basically...
I was walking through the stadium for most of Oregon's first drive where they marched down the field for a touchdown, which was not my favorite drive. And get to the seats, and immediately there's like Oregon fans in front of us flipping off Husky players or something. I don't even know why they're doing that. And it's like, oh, this is going
to
be fun.
They're classy folk. They're voted most likely to be a...
I don't like that term.
What? Classy?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. Well, I voted them most likely to be chewing tobacco during a football game. I can't even imagine what the ground looks like at Autzen Stadium at the end of an Oregon game. But
they're just really comfortable at Husky Stadium, and understandably so, given Oregon's success in this rivalry and at Husky Stadium in particular, but real comfortable.
I mean, that's why I was just like, congrats on the sellout. Like, you're promoting this as a sellout, Huskies. You're playing yourselves. Right?
It's like when the U.S. soccer team sells out a game against Mexico, but it's all fans of L3.
Well, when they were promoting, it's just like, you know what the deal is. Everybody here knows what the deal is. This ain't a sellout, right? You sold 20,000 tickets to Oregon fans. Congrats, University of Washington.
Wow, you estimated 80-20 Husky fans in the stadium. You went back on that? Yeah,
it's all of a sudden seemed like a lot more Oregon fans sure once did. The second half started.
Didn't it? Well, not. I mean, midway through the second half, the start of the second half was good,
and some of them were sitting in my seats. There's so many issues here. That's part of the issue, though. Really, is just that like there's still no home field at UW. It doesn't make sense, right? I didn't even know that I would get here, but it's kind of absurd how good the team has been for the last 5 years, and that there's still no home field whatsoever. And maybe there isn't a home field anywhere in West Coast college football. Maybe that's just the reality of college football.
I think there is at Oregon. They're probably the exception there.
Okay, great.
I mean, so I think a lot of it is factors outside the UW's control, or at least outside the athletic department's control. The fact that UW is no longer really a state university in the traditional sense, in terms of admitting primarily people from the state of Washington who grew up as Husky fans and for whom athletics is like a big part of the college experience, I think is a factor in it.
How is that not true everywhere else, though? This ain't that good of a school. I've looked at the U.S. News and World Report.
Still don't trust that World Report.
Yeah, personally, I'm a World Report guy, but, you know, if you're all in on the U.S. News...
And I think the fact that Seattle has become much more a city of transplants, so those are people that...
Why doesn't it affect literally any other team in Seattle?
Because I think people are more likely to glom onto the like local pro sports team, you know, especially if it's not a direct rival of wherever you came from, than you are the university, which is much more a personal tie of either you went there or your family went there.
I just don't know if I agree with that. I mean, I think there's something about historic... You have to... historic repeated success. But, like, in the 90s when the Huskies owned Seattle, it wasn't because everybody went to UW.
But I think... I mean, obviously not everyone went to UW, but I think a higher proportion of the population had gone to UW. And the other thing is people... Even people that didn't necessarily go to UW maybe went to a non... A school that doesn't have major college football had grown up rooting for UW in an era where... You know, at that point, you were, what, 50, you know, you were, what, 25 years removed from UW being the only game in town from Seattle not having pro sports. Now we're over 50 years removed from that. There's not people that, there's not a lot of people that remember a period of time where UW was the biggest deal.
So is it just that there are no good home crowds in metropolitan cities?
I think it's much harder to do that in a big city. I mean, I don't think you look at, like, you know, Stanford, Cal, I mean, Stanford's a private university, so it's a little different. But, you know, Stanford, Cal, UCLA, I don't think you look at them and say, oh, those are schools that have great home crowds.
Obviously you don't. Like, they have some of the worst home crowds.
Utah, I guess, might be an exception.
They're in a metropolitan city.
We speak no ill of Salt Lake City on this podcast, good sir. Just not real Salt Lake.
We're huge Joe Ingles fans.
Didn't necessarily love the extension to him.
Okay, anyway, that's a complete aside. In game, what happened? Do you want to start by rationalizing or do you want to start by complaining?
I want to start by rationalizing.
Okay.
Because
shocking.
Yeah. I mean, these teams were not that different in this game. That's the thing. It's like, it felt, watching the game, like Oregon ran all over UW in the second half, and that was a primary factor in why they lost. And not that it wasn't a factor at all, but you look at the rushing stats, and they were basically identical for the two teams. UW had better passing stats in this game. I mean, ultimately, probably the biggest difference here was the fact that Oregon converted all five of their trips to the red zone, and UW had to settle for a field goal on one of theirs. And that was the difference of the game.
That's it.
I mean... Really, yeah.
Okay. But why?
And I mean,
that can't be it. They were up by two touchdowns. What happened? How did Oregon come back?
I mean, and that's where Oregon's success running the ball and then the problems that created in the UW secondary is an issue. But, you know, people want to pin this on the offense because of the fact that they stopped scoring after scoring, you know, 31 points. I mean, that's more points than Oregon had given up in their previous five games combined. This is a team that had allowed more than 200 yards passing once all season, and UW had 289. The offense was great in this game. The offense did not lose this game. The offense did not lose this season. The defense has been the culprit in all three of these games, and somehow in a way that has kind of let them off the hook and forced people to be much more upset about the offensive coordinating in particular.
The defense has been so good historically that you give them a bit of a pass.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's been a good season for Jimmy Lake. I don't think that means that, you know, Jimmy Lake is a bad defensive coach or anything like that. But
he has an extremely young defense.
Yeah.
And an extremely inexperienced defense.
I don't know that precludes you from making a tackle and running up the middle at some point, or, you know, maybe trying to do, you know, something a little bit different with your front six.
Okay, so as Jimmy Lang, we've talked a little bit about this, that Chris Peterson is not in his... in his career has not really had to play from behind all that often, has not had to go into a battle having a weaker team than the other team, right? He's almost always had the superior team, both coached and talent-wise. Has Jimmy Lake not had to develop the sort of ability to adjust on the fly because he's always had the best defense?
I mean, I don't know about the best defense, but he's always had a high-quality defense.
He's almost always had a better defense than his opponent, though.
And it does seem increasingly clear that Ben Burkervin solved a lot of problems for the Huskies by just flying from one side of the field to the other and making tackles everywhere.
So good!
Like, that would be nice to have. Ugh. Could use that.
There really is no linebacker who just cleans up everything.
There definitely isn't. It was surprising after Ariel Nata played so well at inside linebacker at Arizona that he basically exclusively played rush linebacker in this game. That was surprising.
Surprising.
Yeah. And, of course, it did not help the Huskies get any pressure whatsoever on Justin Herbert. Except when they blitzed.
It was such a frustrating game, though, where it's like, you could feel a moment. I think it was, so the Huskies were up 28-14. And what was the first touchdown that Oregon scored to get to 28-21? Which one was that?
That was a 14-yard run up the middle midway through the third quarter.
I feel like that was the moment when you could just, in the stadium, you could feel the Huskies get tight, right? And normally you look at them and you're like, this team has the confidence of a team that is better than everybody that they play. And for whatever reason, it felt a little bit like they were surprised to be there. They were surprised at how well they'd played in this game, and the offense in particular. And I think, obviously, in general, the issue wasn't the offense, but from pretty much that point forward, the offense didn't do anything right.
Well, the offense did move the ball in the subsequent possession. That's when they had to settle for the field goal. Had a 3rd and 12, got an 8-yard completion to Chico McClatcher on a screen pass, and decided not to go for 4th and 4 and kick the field goal from that point.
This was when they were tied, though.
No, they were already up. They were still
this
up.
Is to go up 10.
Yes. And then
that's what I'm saying about getting tight, though.
Then Oregon scored a touchdown.
Earlier in the game,
at the end of the third
there's
quarter.
A 4th down, and they go for it and run a Jacob Eason option, right, for a touchdown. Whereas this, now they're up, and all of a sudden they're playing like...
And I got to admit, in the moment, just based on the momentum of the game, I did feel like, look, if Oregon gets a stop here, that suddenly is... You know,
we might lose this thing.
I was okay with the decision. It wasn't a short 4th down. It was a makeable 4th down, but it wasn't a short.
Okay, then what about the 3rd and 2 subsequently? Huskies are up 31-28. Have not stopped Oregon more or less in the entire second half.
Yeah, they have a 3rd and 2 at their own 28 and run the Wildcat for a loss of 2 yards. Now,
this is the Wildcat with Kamari Pleasant.
But no, okay, don't right. jump to that.
Okay.
I think in general the Wildcat is overly maligned, that people have some sort of visceral dislike of it that is not justified by the numbers, which is what Chris Peterson cited in explaining why they continue to run it. Now, that was true last year with Miles Gaskin running the Wildcat, and it was true earlier this season with Richard Newton running the Wildcat. He's out. You've got a backup in that spot in Kamari Pleasant. And then you've also got a backup, you know, they line this up a second running back alongside him. Throughout this season, that's been Sean McGrew. He also missed this game. And so that put, I'm not even sure who was the running back who was in on the Wildcat piece. It wasn't Cameron Davis.
Cameron Davis?
It was not him who got his first career carry in this game and ran for 7 yards before having another 7-yard run called back for holding. So I'm not even sure who it was. I'm going to have to take a second to fill as I look up. It was number 36, which is Malik Braxton, who may be a walk-on. So you've got your backup.
The face that I'm making doesn't come through over podcast.
Yeah, it doesn't.
So we have Kamari Pleasant, who is 4th string on the Huskies running back depth chart, with coming through as the back there.
6th running back.
6th string running back who I've literally never heard of.
Yep.
This is the decision that they made. But the reality was they were never handing that ball off. It didn't matter who was back there. And that's the thing that's the problem with this play. Like, even though it's worked, the primary... I've complained about this to you so much. The primary advantage that the offense has over the defense is that the defense doesn't know what the offense is going to do. And in this play, the defense knew what the offense was going to do.
I don't agree with that, because the play that everyone wants them to run, and me included, is a sneak, where everyone knows what you're going to do on a sneak, but it doesn't matter because you can't stop it anyway.
I don't know if we needed them to run a sneak on 3rd and 2.
It would have been a long sneak.
I would like them to sneak more often in general, but even then, you feel like you have the physical advantage if you are running a sneak. And it's like, it's one of the plays that you can telegraph and might still work no matter what, because you have a monstrous quarterback, or Jake Browning, who's also excellent at sneaking. But it's like, do something. Don't take the ball out of Jacob Eason's hands. Do something else. There's the whole host of plays that you have available to you at 3rd and 2. You're not limited to anything. You don't have to run a wildcat. You can pass. You can run. You can do anything. Also, you're starting running back. It's not like running backs number 1 through 5 were all injured. Your number one running back is still on the fucking team. Put the ball into his hands. Why can he not be the wildcat running back? He can't receive a handoff from the shotgun and pretend to hand it off to somebody?
I don't think he's effective at running between the tackles. You were the one who've complained about this in the past.
He was effective at running between the tackles in this game. He was effective at doing everything in this game.
I think he did most of his damage to the edges.
Savon Ahmed is good at doing everything. Right? There's nothing that Savon Ahmed can't do. And if there's a hole, he's going to hit it, and he's going to hit it a hell of a lot faster than Kamari Pleasant is. But the other thing is, if you're going to run the Wildcat, you need to have multitudes for when you're doing it. You can't do the same shit every time. If you're going to put Kamari Pleasant back there...
But you can't. I'm telling you, the numbers can't. You did.
You can't. Not with Kamari Pleasant. Maybe with Richard Newton, you don't need to. Also, if Richard Newton needs to throw the damn ball, he probably would.
Yeah, but you're trusting Kamari Pleasant, who hasn't practiced this as much, to make those decisions, to make those reads?
No, I'm saying they shouldn't have run it at all. But the reality is, you're on time. How many times did they run it before this? This wasn't
Twice.
The first time Oregon had seen the Wildcat.
It had not worked either time.
They ran it twice in the game and it didn't work either time.
No, they had run it twice before that.
And it previously hadn't worked either time.
Yep.
Are you fucking kidding me? But they just go back to it. It's just like...
But you just can't take this out on the entire play. It's like saying, it didn't work when Jake Haener passed at Cal last year, so we should never pass.
It was the decision to run that play in that moment. Run the Wildcat in the future. I don't care. Don't run the Wildcat.
A lot of people do care, as it turns out.
Who cares what they say? That's not what we're talking about. We are talking about one snapshot.
So the season's over now.
Can we talk about the last drive, though, before then?
What?
Because the Huskies get the ball down 35-31 with a little over 5 minutes left. And you're kind of thinking, this could be an Eason moment, right? This could be the defining moment of his UW career, coming down, scoring a touchdown in what would most likely beat Oregon, right? But there's just, and this is where it comes down to, Bush Hamden, where I feel like the confidence you have, I mean, like, look, if we have Russell Wilson in this drive, no matter what happened the next day, you feel like he's going to score here, right? But with a quarterback like Jacob Eason, who's pretty much never done it in his career, who's new to the situation, we have not seen him in these pressure situations, and with the play calling of Bush Hamden, you just said to yourself, like, oh, this would be so amazing, but I don't feel the same level of confidence. And they moved the ball fairly well on the drive.
They moved it okay. I mean, they picked up a 3rd and 5 with 6 yards. It was not exactly the most confident. They did have the 22-yard pickup to Cade Otton on the first play of this drive. And you're right that Cade Otton is actually their best weapon.
Cade!
I mean, where things stalled out, there's 2nd and 6 at Oregon's 38 with 2 minutes left. And Eason gets sacked on a play where...
Brutal sack.
They were asking... I assume it was Ahmed, but the running back was the only blocker to take a blitzing linebacker who came through much too quickly for anything to be done about it. That's a 12-yard loss all the way back to the 50. They subsequently have a false start on 3rd and 18 at the 50. That was where I tweeted that this is a poorly coached team. I may have been a little rash, but it wasn't a great sequence of plays. And then they actually did pick up 20 yards to Marquise Spiker to set up a 4th and 3, where for the umpteenth time this season, they went to slants in a short yardage pass situation. And I'm told that I haven't watched this replay. I don't know if I can stomach it.
I saw the on-the-field replay. I haven't seen the TV version. I just saw an on-the-field replay. It sure looks like the defender got there early.
I'm told it was pass interference. I've also seen that people said that it was a drop by Nacua. Was the pass on target?
I think the pass was on target. I think the defender got there a little bit early. They probably weren't going to call it ever. It doesn't fucking matter. Life is bad.
Sounds about right.
So, can I just... do your thing about the season being over.
The Huskies have 3 conference losses. Oregon has none. Oregon has the tiebreaker. It's the race is over already.
I mean, they're not going to the Rose Bowl. They're not going to a New Year's Six Bowl. But also, this is... When you just list off the names, right? And you're like, this is who the Huskies were counting on, especially on defense. And you're like, well, they have all the returning stars. Miles Bryant. We thought Kyler Gordon would be good.
Kyler Gordon did have one really nice breakup in this game. It was very exciting.
But it's more or less been benched.
I mean, benched is strong.
You're like, Elijah Molden's pretty solid. But I mean, this is not, if we're rationalizing, which I don't know if we should. We had very high expectations, and it's happened in the past where they have flipped over.
But see, this is the thing that often happens with the Seahawks. People are like, "What happened in the past? It's gonna this improbable thing happened in the past. It's gonna happen again." Like, that's not a guarantee of future success. Past returns are no guarantee of future performance.
The Seahawks only had one good defense.
I mean, they had a good defense for a period of several years.
But they only had one good generation of good defensive players, and have really not replaced those players.
Fair.
The Huskies have done it over...
In terms of people are like, look, as long as they can be .500 at midseason, they'll go rip off a 6-game winning streak, and then 2017 happens,
but
and you realize
you
that's not a guarantee.
The difference between Michael Bennett and LJ Collier. But I'm saying, like...
You're focusing too much on the wrong thing. I'm saying that just people say that this improbable thing happened before, so therefore it will happen again.
The improbable thing happened with the Huskies like 3 generations in a row, right? I mean, we're talking the first time when they lost Shaq Thompson and Danny Shelton and Marcus Peters. We were like, there's no way that
Marcus Peters has played for like 3 NFL teams since then.
But when those players left, we were like, there's no way that they can replace these players, right? And then they replaced them.
Right. And
with another generation of players who all went to the NFL again. And then it happened again. And it was just like, maybe this team, but I think there was maybe too much turnover on the defense this year.
Yes.
It finally caught up to them. And on offense, we don't know what's going to happen with Jacob Eason. I'm really willing to make whatever wager you would like that he goes to the NFL after this season, because he's going to the NFL after the season. But if this is Jacob Eason's only college season, I think it would be frustrating to have not been able to pair a good defense with Jacob Eason at quarterback.
With like a solid 6th in the Pac-12 in QBR.
You're the worst.
CBS Sports had a piece. I'm unable to bring it up for some reason right now because your internet appears to be down.
It seems, I don't know.
Well, it's down for me.
Your ESPN internet restricts you from going to CBS Sports.
I read it earlier. And it talked about him outplaying Herbert in this game, but the concluding line was like, he might go to the NFL next season, not he will go.
Well, okay.
It was a draft breakdown, said he might go to the NFL.
What was the QBR? Because you said Herbert had a better QBR than Jacob Eason in this game.
I mean, they were very similar. It was like 80.4 to 77. I can't
pull
it up.
That just doesn't make sense.
Again,
to me.
My internet is no longer working.
I turned off your internet.
Harsh but fair.
You're playing on the road today. But that's all I'm saying is that I think it would be frustrating because we know that Jacob Eason is a good quarterback. You still won't admit this?
We
God, you fucking Browning stans cannot help yourself.
But
23 of 30 for 285 yards against what you called the second best defense in all of college football.
I say best pass defense, but yeah.
Oh, the second best pass defense. That's still what he was playing against.
That is what he was doing.
I don't think this was an impressive performance?
It was obviously an impressive performance. I'm saying there's been other games in the season which you are conveniently omitting.
Jake Browning never played well against a single good pass defense in his entire career.
Dubious, because Stanford 2016 defense was probably a joke. I think people are a little too excited. Can I play Kevin Downer? People are too excited about the young receivers. Like, Puka Nacua's touchdown was awesome, but overall he caught 3 of 6 targets, granting that one of them apparently should have been a pass interference.
Egregious pass interference.
And if you add up the young wide receivers, counting them as Bynum, Nacua, and Spiker, they had 8.2 yards per target in this game. Everybody else had 10.8 yards per target.
So it was actually K-Dot much more. Out. You don't compare K-Dot and
you got to throw Jordan Chin out, because for the second consecutive game, he had a long reception, a 48 yard reception on his only target.
I'm not sure if your sample size is big enough. We'll see what happens.
Let's not push Aaron Fuller aside because of the
Nobody's
fact that we're
pushing
excited.
Aaron Fuller aside.
People are
he
pushing
got
Aaron
hurt.
Fuller aside.
He's pushing himself aside.
Yeah, I'm not saying that Coach Pete is pushing him aside.
That's the other thing, though. Okay, so you want to talk about Jake Mason? He's playing this game against the second best pass defense in the fucking country with Jordan Chin, Puka Nacua, Marquis Spiker, Terrell Bynum, Cade Otton, Aaron Fuller. Like, there are no experienced receivers on the field.
Bryant. Just an experienced receiver.
Put some respect on Kate Otten's name. And
3 catches for 65 yards. Here's the thing. Is like I said, this was a good game for the Huskies, a really good game for the Huskies offense, which has been better than their defense this season. But you know what was frustrating about this game? What? It's not the fact that they lost this game. It's the fact that you can play this well against a really good Oregon team and lose to fucking Cal and Stanford.
I know.
That's what's frustrating about
I know.
It. Because if it was their first loss of the year, season, they'd be fine.
Fine. I like that we're both still angry about Cal and Stanford. I meant that the Cal game is whatever. Like, there was a unique circumstance that happened there.
I do not agree that it was
all Bush Hamden's fault. I know that the offense has been better, but it should be so much better. And that those drives at the end of the game against Cal were amateur drives.
But they took the lead in that game. That should have been able to hold up. They were playing against a Cal team that had no offense.
Ugh, I hate everything about this team. But the other thing that I hate is the sport of football.
Oh, great point. It's
because
a bad
the
sport.
Reality is there was a probable pass interference on the last meaningful play of the game, and all of a sudden we need to freak out. And it's just like, why is the magnitude so high here? Like, not that there should be an 18 playoff in college football. Not that the Huskies would ever sniff that 18 playoff this year. But
if there was an
80
team
playoff,
you
can't lose one or two games and have your whole year be over with. There should be a 64-team college football playoff. It's just stupid. It is stupid that we care so much about this. And it's like, it's so results-based. And that's what's frustrating about it. It's like Jacob Eason plays this excellent game, and nobody cares because he didn't happen to win the game. Because
I think a lot of people care about it. I disagree with that.
Hate paying attention to football.
So speaking of teams that lost a game and it doesn't end their season... The Seattle Seahawks suffering a 30-16 home loss on Sunday against Baltimore.
Let me ask you a question right now. Who is the better team within the confines of their own sport or whatever league that they play in? The Seahawks or the Huskies?
So are we saying, like...
Who's better? The Seahawks in the NFL and the Huskies in college.
But are we going by, like, percentile rank? Because there's only 32 teams in the NFL and there's 130 in college football.
I don't. You can go by whatever metric you want. I'm just asking you a question.
The Seahawks are the better team relative to their league.
You feel really confident about that?
No.
Okay.
But they're 7th out of 32, and the Huskies are like at best 3rd out of 12.
The Seahawks.
Well, maybe they're 2nd out of 12.
The Seahawks are like the Huskies, probably with a slightly worse defense than the Huskies have, and a better offense. And much better play calling.
Wow, much better play. I see. We've got to talk about this.
The reality is Jacob Eason is not in the same ballpark, even though John Elway will draft him higher than Russell Wilson was drafted. he's not in the same ballpark as Russell Wilson is as a quarterback. And Russell Wilson is still, despite this last weekend, means that the Seahawks are probably a better team within the NFL than the Huskies are within college.
Let's complain about the play calling for the Seahawks now. You don't want to complain about it?
I can't rationalize the Husky game, but I can rationalize the fuck out of the Seahawks.
And you're rationalizing it with the rain?
Do you want me to go there?
Sure.
The Seahawks have lost two games this year. Both of those games have had driving rain, have been some of the darkest days that we've seen in the city of Seattle, like all of calendar year 2019.
That's great, because the weather usually gets better in November and December, right?
I mean, no, this is a long-term issue that they can't play in the rain. But every time, we talked about this the last time they lost a game like this, right? And both of the games that they lost, they have given up two touchdowns, both by turnover or the non-defensive touchdowns, right?
Yeah.
That were not scored. So I'm just like, the reality is if you have two turnovers in a game and they both go for touchdowns, the chances of you winning that game is probably zero, right?
Yeah, that's probably true.
If 100% of your, if you have more than one turnover and 100% of your turnovers go for touchdowns, the chances of you winning are extraordinarily low. And it was raining really hard and Russ don't play in the rain.
But it wasn't Russ's fault in this game.
Just because Russ didn't have receivers open, he played the worst game that he's...
Did you see the stat that Pete Carroll apparently cited during the press conference today?
It was probably some horseshit if Pete Carroll cited it.
No, this is... Wow.
I'm just saying, Pete Carroll doesn't cite good stats.
I kind of want to listen back to some of the old Win Forever pods and think how young we were.
Do you think that on those Win Forever pods, we thought that Pete Carroll was citing good stats? Because
no,
you think probably Pete not. Carroll knows the difference between a good and a bad stat?
The stat he cited was that of Wilson's 21 incompletions in the game, which is a lot of incompletions, as it turns out, 12 of them were throwaways.
Herbert territory. That's the thing. Okay, wait, I got fired up. Okay, do you want to know, this hit me the other week, why commentators love Aaron Rodgers?
Because he throws the ball away a lot?
Because he throws the ball away so often, and nothing gets commentators harder than a throwaway, right? Because they're like, oh, what a play. You know what I mean? It's like he makes sometimes great passes and he throws the ball away and they ignore every shitty pass that he throws because I saw a couple, but it's just like there's nothing that sports reporters love more than a throwaway because they're like, oh, that's heady. That's heady.
Ideally, you wouldn't have that many throwaways because you'd, you know, have some open receivers and maybe you'd try to scheme that.
It was a Rodgers-like performance by Russ on Sunday.
So as we were having this argument, as you were driving home from the game, I speculated that it would be Wilson's worst expected completion percentage by the NFL advanced stats of the last couple years. Now, it turns out that wasn't the case. He had a lower game last season against Minnesota thanks to Keegan Adobo.
That game is just gone from my mind.
Me too.
What was it? It was here.
Yes.
And we won?
I think we lost.
We lost.
Or am I thinking of the Atlanta game?
I feel like I remember almost every Seahawks game that there was, but this one just like really disappeared.
I'm going to have to go to the phone because I still have no internet.
Is my internet working?
There were a couple of games where he had a lower expected completion percentage.
I do remember there being a pretty ugly still game against the Vikings. I don't know. My internet's working fine, so I don't know what your internet's problem is.
It still was one of the lowest expected completion percentages of the last two seasons, which I think to some extent is testament to what Baltimore did defensively.
They beat the Vikings 21-7.
No.
In that game.
Baltimore played a lot of man coverage, brought a lot of pressure in this game, and did so quite effectively. And I think one thing we learned is that if you do that against the Seahawks, their receivers are not capable of winning one-on-one quick enough to make you pay. And that's probably not surprising given what we thought about their receiver core coming into the season, but it's troubling nonetheless. That's like my long-term concern out of this game.
How much of that has to do with Earl Thomas?
It might be a lot. That I definitely concede that possibility, especially because of the fact that it's not just Earl Thomas patrolling so much ground as free safety. It's also him bringing insight to Baltimore about what the Seahawks are looking to do offensively.
I mean, there's almost no person on earth who understands what the Seahawks are going to do on offense better than Earl Thomas, including maybe offensive coordinators of theirs.
What if Earl Thomas were as our offensive coordinator? Have we considered that?
Well, we want him as the defensive coordinator.
I think it'd be kind of fun to have him as the offensive coordinator. He calls up the plays he knows he couldn't stop.
Yeah. We'll have Earl on offense and Sherm on defense. I do look forward to that part of the
Seahawks timeline.
Yeah, the Seahawks timeline when former players can start being coordinators for the team. Lord knows we're not that excited about Ken Norton. Wait, I had one more thought about Chris Peterson also. Before we leave the Huskies for good.
Okay, I thought we had done that.
For the year.
Wow.
You said the year's
over. We're putting them in M's Hot Takes territory?
Can everybody just chill the fuck out? Chris Peterson has been the best coach in Husky history since Don James. He loses 3 games frustratingly in 1 year with a team that's basically entirely brand new. Even the starting quarterback we're excited about is a first-year starting quarterback.
Some of us are more excited about it than others.
His receivers, as I mentioned earlier, were almost all freshmen. It's just like...
There also have been a number of untimely injuries this year for the Huskies.
And yeah, that you find out about right as you're walking into the stadium.
Yeah.
The team cannot perform, and especially not at this point, like in the Chris Peterson tenure. There are basically no teams that are at New Year's Six level every single year. You're talking about having one of the best programs in the country. Like, and even then, you're talking about the Alabamas, the Clemsons, the Ohio States.
Yep.
Beyond that, there's really nobody else. Maybe Oklahoma, but they were down even before Lincoln Riley, right?
Sure. I agree. So it's like, I think it's been an off year for the coaching staff, but I don't think that, you know, with the possible exception of Bush Hamden, that it dramatically changes my long-term outlook for the program.
I'm not saying that they shouldn't necessarily, and we'll see how the rest of the season plays out, make changes on the coaching staff. And I do think that they're probably better offensive coordinators than Bush Hamden out there. They're not better coaches than Chris Peterson.
Most of them are offensive coordinators in the Dallas Cowboys.
God.
Less chances of Kellen Moore getting fired after Sunday. It's a shame.
We should really be cheering against the Cowboys.
Well, we should be cheering against the Cowboys.
Save for maybe Dabo and Nick Saban, that there are better coaches in the entire country for college football than Chris Peterson.
I think the list may now be slightly longer than that, but I'm not sure who's off the top of my head specifically. Lincoln
Riley.
Possibly.
All right. Do you want me to say the same thing about the Seahawks?
I was going to ask the question. Are you going to say the same thing about Pete Carroll?
Absolutely. I don't care what decisions Pete Carroll makes wrong. The reality is there are not better coaches out there than Pete Carroll. There are better coaches out there than Pete Carroll. There are not better coaches out there that the Seahawks would hire than Pete Carroll. This is it. This is the best we got for now.
It's just... The irony of a team that is, we've mentioned it before, but the irony of a team that whose fan base is so statistically driven, having a coach who is steering the other direction, steering away from the skid, it's frustrating.
I think about how many years Sean Payton had as the Saints coach where they didn't make the playoffs, they're a frustrating team, and they stuck with Sean Payton, and eventually he got the defense together, right? He had the quarterback for over a decade, and then finally the defense got together, and now the Saints are one of the best teams in the NFL. Pete Carroll will have another defense.
Okay.
When you have the quarterback, you'll eventually have another defense. Right now, the biggest issue with the Seahawks has nothing to do with Russell Wilson, has nothing to do with the offense. It's that this defense just isn't very good.
I mean, look, the Seahawks have never been able to stop running quarterbacks. That's always been a weakness in their defensive scheme. So I'm not really that concerned about what happened on defense in this game. I actually thought
the offense also gave up 2 touchdowns.
Yeah, I thought the secondary played really well. Trey Flowers, this is probably his best game of the season.
Trey Flowers is back, by the way.
Marquise Blair did an admirable job of filling in with Lano Hill and Bradley McDougald both out, and I think that we'd probably like to see him in Tedrick Thompson's spot going forward because... Tedrick Thompson at least was in the wrong place on the biggest breakdown defensively for the Seahawks that didn't involve Tavares Jackson. Yeah, I wish Tavares Jackson could have run like that. Man, wouldn't that have been fun?
Jackson.
Lamar Jackson scrambling. Or designed running.
Tavares Jackson did nothing wrong?
I mean, off the field, Tavares Jackson did some things
really
wrong.
Yeah,
that was the end of his tenure. Yeah. is in terms of calling the coin toss, Tavares Jackson did nothing wrong. So, yeah, the defense, I'm not that concerned about this game. I have some concerns about the offense, but the real concern is the decision making.
You're not that concerned about the defense after this game?
I'm not more concerned about the defense after this game than I was going into this game.
The defense got lucky to give up. I mean,
they got a lot of Mark Andrews drops.
On the whole, they only ended up giving up 16 points themselves.
But one thing that happens when you give up a pick six is you don't have a defensive possession on that one.
That was near the end of the half, but yes.
It helps skew the numbers a little bit. But, like, again, I'm not more concerned about the defense coming out of this game than I was going in. I'm not that much more concerned about the offense.
Lamar's the best.
I am that much more concerned about the coaching.
Let's just...
Because it's not just that they kicked a 53-yard field goal on 4th-and-3. It's that Pete Carroll then goes on his radio show Monday morning and says that not only did they not consider going for it, that if they weren't going to kick the field goal, the alternative was that they were going to punt from the opposing 35 instead. And that's just who they are as a football team, and makes it clear that he has not rethought the idea that Jason Myers is a human kicking machine whatsoever, based on the fact that he's already missed as many field goals this season in 11 attempts as he did last year in 33 attempts. Yep. There's no learning going on here. There's only the opposite.
Yep.
I mean, it's bad. And now here's the thing in terms of...
All I'm saying about this is that they should not fire Pete Carroll. That's it. And you don't think that they should fire Pete Carroll either.
Yeah, I don't think that. I think they should maybe lock him in his office and not allow him to, like... You know, I don't know what would really get Pete Carroll. Not allow him to play basketball until he hires a game management coordinator. I can think of some people who work for the Ravens who might be interested in the job who would probably be pretty good at it. And congrats to Sean as well as Earl Thomas.
Oh, great. Yeah. The reality is, like, is John Harbaugh probably a better coach than Pete Carroll is? Yes. Did John Harbaugh make better in-game decisions than Pete Carroll did? Some, right?
I mean, he kicked some very cowardly field goals early in this game. And it's also a lot easier to go for fourth down if you have Lamar Jackson and the threat that he posed, and he can't be tackled.
There's no such thing as a perfect coach. There are coaches who have blind spots and who make bad decisions. There are coaches who are better in-game than they are at coaching itself. Like, the reality is you have to give up some things.
It's not a couple years ago. Like, a couple years ago, Pete was making the same conservative decisions as every NFL coach. Now, I don't know if you saw that chart and it was a little different based on expected points, but based on win probability, they're not going for it on fourth down. Their fourth down decisions, they're the only team that has lost win probability on fourth down.
Oh, God.
You know, when you're in range to go in four down territory. Every other team in the NFL has gained win probability there.
It changes what we're mad at the Seahawks about throughout time. Whereas, like, I don't think I think they're running, maybe they didn't run enough play action in this game. But it does feel like their run-pass splits have gotten a little better. We're not quite as angry.
They passed the ball a lot. They definitely attempted to let Russ cook. I don't think it was too much. But it was a lot.
On that fourth down, sitting there in the stadium, I didn't even bother standing up to watch the field goal.
You knew what the result was going to be.
I knew it was coming. You know what I mean? And even if he hit it, I wouldn't have been that excited about it, because it was still a bad decision. That's the problem with this decision, was not that I never considered the idea of punting. That was a wild outlier. But basically, there were three options for them in this moment, in an inflection point, right? And I think that they basically, their first and second choices in this moment of number one, kicking the field goal, number two, punting, and then as clearly a distant number three, going for it, maybe didn't even cross their minds. Maybe didn't even know that you could go for it on fourth downs. They chose their first two choices were the decisions that helped them win the game the least.
Yeah. It was probably in reverse order of the way, because it... I mean, especially in those conditions, I think a punt actually was in some ways a more sensible play than the 53-yard field goal.
Imagine how much we would have lost our mind about that, though. And I also don't think that the situations were created equal of the Ravens going for it and the Seahawks hypothetically going for it.
Agreed.
I mean, it was an easier choice to go for it for the Ravens than it was for the Seahawks.
I mean, I don't know that I would have felt good about their chances of making it on fourth down, fourth and three, but it just would have had so much more higher upside if you would have made it than, you know, the chance of hitting that field goal.
So then you have to walk it back to another decision, which is the decision to massively overpay Jason Myers because you felt it's like in fantasy where I don't get a player that I wanted and then they have a monster year and then I draft them and then they suck the next year. It's just like they felt jilted that they had this Pro Bowl kicker.
Except you don't get to just change the roster the next year in real football, as it turns out.
But is that just a Pete Carroll decision? He's not the GM.
No.
Like, there's more to
it. It's
an
organization-wide thing.
Your question of will Pete ever learn, you know what the answer is to that.
It was rhetorical.
It was frustrating, yes. But the reality is the weather was horrible. It benefits running in those types of games more. And the Seahawks, ironically, are a shitty running team. Russ couldn't cook.
Well, they're not good at the things they think they want to be good at, including run defense and including kicking.
Russ couldn't cook in the way he
wants
to.
Or special teams in general.
Right? The kitchen was all muddied. And that's really what happened in this game.
But here's the thing is...
They couldn't set Russ up to save them from themselves.
Yes, it's just one game. But one game is really important for the Seahawks right now because they are in a shitty situation in the NFC West. The LA Rams... In Jalen Ramsey's debut, dominated the team the Seahawks will play on Sunday, the Falcons, 37-10 in Atlanta. The 49ers won in even rainier conditions, 9-0 to go to 6-0.
They beat the second worst team in the league. Congrats.
The top two teams, it doesn't matter. The top two teams in the NFC North both won.
Why doesn't nobody else play anybody? I'm just like, I see all these Patriots and they're like, the Patriots defense has outscored offense and they play. It's like, great. You've played the Dolphins.
I don't think the Seahawks defense would outscore those offenses.
It doesn't matter. It's like the Seahawks.
If then the Seahawks it does played matter.
The exact same schedule, they probably would have lost to the Bills. so Josh Allen would have gone for 450 against them.
So the rushing. Seahawks playoff odds dropped by 17 percentage points, according to Football Outsiders, now putting them below 50-50 to make the playoffs at 46%. I mean, team, you know, we've been operating because of the fact that they were 5-1 and they just generally make the playoffs as if this is a sure playoff team. And they are not. That is not the case. Like I was saying about the improbable things that people just expect to continue.
If they were to get to, let's say that hypothetically speaking, they won the next two and got to 7-2, even then, I don't think their playoff odds would necessarily be that high.
Yeah, they'd climb over 60 probably.
It would still be, it wouldn't be what it would normally be in a 7-2 year though.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, I look at that and it's
extreme
like,
NBA levels of conference imbalance.
They need to get to 7-2 just to have a chance.
Yeah. So that means they need to beat the Atlanta Falcons, who suffered their fifth consecutive loss last Sunday in that game to the Rams, falling to 1-6 on the season, and also saw Matt Ryan leave the game with an ankle sprain after being sacked by Aaron Donald, their embattled coach, Dan Quinn. I enjoy an embattled coach, said that the team will prepare both ways as if Ryan could play and as if he can't, in which case he would be replaced by longtime backup Matt Schaub, who last started a game in 2015.
Wow. It's been that long.
Yeah, Schaub did go 6 of 6 for 66 yards and a touchdown in garbage time.
That's a spooky number, and it's like they may be playing a ghost this weekend right before Halloween.
Well, you saw the line from Sam Darnold during tonight's game, right?
Oh, that he was seeing ghosts.
And literally no one amazingly had tweeted, Sam Darnold sees ghosts sometimes.
Did you?
No, I didn't. I didn't get around to it.
Wow, you're just dropping verbal tweets over here.
Yeah. This is the people listening to the podcast are literally the only people who would potentially get that joke. So
Ben B doesn't.
Yeah, he's
the only one listening now. So
do you want to guess what team Matt Schaub played for when he last started a game?
He played for a team after the Texans before the Falcons.
He played for two teams between the Texans.
Well, he was
and
on
Falcons.
The Colts for a while.
Nope.
Is that right?
Not one of them. I mean, you're sort of in the ballpark in a sense.
Bears?
No. All right, this is becoming too much
data. I'm trying to remember Matt Schaub playing for it. Was he on? I have no idea.
So the first team he was on was the Oakland Raiders, where I'm pretty sure he got beat out by Derek Carr for the starting job in that week 4 game.
Yeah.
against the Seahawks at the end of the preseason, but the team he started for was the Baltimore Ravens in 2015, going 1-1.
You know what? I think I might have actually blocked Matt Schaub's Ravens tenure out of my mind.
The question is whether Ravens fans black that out of their
mind. Whatever happened, it led to them getting Lamar Jackson, so it's the right timeline.
Yeah, it worked out in the end. So it'll be interesting to see whether the fact that they have a bye after this week factors into their decision. It also seems to suggest that this might be the last game for Dan Quinn as the Falcons head coach.
Matt Ryan is not playing in this game. Like, the reality is, Matt Ryan is still the Falcons franchise quarterback. The season's over for the Falcons, right? They're 1-5. They are 5 games back in their division.
1-6.
They are 5 games back in their division. They would have to win out. They would have to win 9 in a row to even consider a wild card. You're not even guaranteed a wild card spot winning out at this point.
Yeah.
No, the season's over. Sure. It's done. There is no need for them heading into a bye week to even hypothetically risk Matt Ryan getting injured again.
Ryan is still completing 71% of his passes this season, but his yards per completion have been down, and his interception rate is his highest since 2009. He's already thrown 8 picks this season, which is 7 more than Russell Wilson.
But you heard what I'm saying. We can go into this game, and reports seem to suggest that Schaub is going to be starting, but
it doesn't sound like Ryan is going to practice much this week, if at all.
It would be full on. It would be Dan Quinn trying to save his job. It would be a disservice to the future of the Falcons for him to start Matt Ryan in this game.
I mean, it's an ankle injury. It's not like there's that much risk of long-term
recurrence. But it's just like, what is the point? For who? For what?
I agree. Shouts to Ricky Waters.
They should be playing for a draft pick at this point.
The Falcons entered the week 14th in offensive of DVOA, 29th on defense, 31st in pass defense. They have forced just 1 turnover since week 2. They're -8 turnover differential overall. Have a league low 5 sacks, and opponents are completing 70% of their passes, which ranks 29th in the league for 8.2 net yards per attempt, which ranks 30th. The Falcons lost safety Keanu Neal to an Achilles rupture in week 3 after he tore his ACL in week 1 in 2018. So a kind of Will Disley-esque track record of significant injuries early in seasons for Neal lately. Desmond Trufant, the former Husky, Truf has missed the last 2 weeks with a toe injury in the secondary. Offensively, Devontae Freeman hasn't been able to get much of anything going, averaging just 3.5 yards per carry this season. Julio Jones has only been okay. He's got 40 catches for 560 yards and 4 touchdowns, 9.0 yards per target. The one player to watch for the Atlanta Falcons is, of course, Austin Hooper. On one of my 3 fantasy teams. He is 5th in the NFL with 46 receptions and 5th among tight ends with 9.6 yards per target. He entered in last week, led tight ends by almost 50 DR in Football Outsiders player value metric.
And he is going to be excellent on the Seahawks on Sunday.
What draft pick are they giving up for Austin Hooper?
What pick would you give up for Austin? Would you give up a third round draft pick?
I don't know. I mean, it depends
how
good.
If they're offering you a third round draft pick for Hooper, you're taking that trade.
I don't know if they are. I guess so.
But you personally?
Yeah, probably.
You throwing Austin Hooper into this offense? I mean, he's the last piece for the Seahawks. It's just like, I actually came up with a really good trade that I think would complete both these teams.
Okay.
So you send Ben Burkervin back to college. Kate Otten to the NFL.
Wow.
Who says really? No?
I say yes on behalf of both of those.
Right? I mean, both teams are, if you could just make that switch, both teams are so much better instantly.
Huskies would take Cody Barton too.
Yeah, it's kind of wild that Cody Barton, I mean, he's not even playing. It's like, God. The Huskies could use him desperately. I think a lot of these things, like, I mean, we know that running backs, Devontae Freeman not being able to get anything going, who cares? We know that he's at the whim of everything else in their offense, and their offense has still been good and has had moments where they've looked very good and have put up huge numbers. But still, it's just like dropping and dropping and dropping, where now if you have an average offense and one of the worst defenses, you're looking at one of the worst teams in the NFL.
And what if you don't even have an average offense if you don't have Matt Ryan out there? It's kind of amazing the line on this game is only 5.5.
Well, it hasn't been confirmed who's starting.
The Seahawks also do have a tendency to play really poorly against bad teams, but...
I would say a couple of things here. Number one, thank the Lord, they're playing in a dome.
Exactly.
Number two, this is not Teddy Bridgewater and the Saints coming to town. Right?
It's not.
There's a huge difference between these two things. Number one, Matt Schaub. Like, there's, I think there's a pretty massive difference between Matt Schaub and Teddy Bridgewater just as players, but also... They're not similar teams whatsoever, right? Like, just as blanket backup quarterbacks that the Seahawks have faced, these are not comparable whatsoever.
Their defenses are not comparable.
You're talking about one of the worst defenses in the league and a quarterback who hasn't started a game in 4 years with some decent options. I think that the Falcons are right on the brink of really falling apart for the season.
Yeah,
and maybe they
likely
already have.
As I look at this, the Seahawks have won 5 of their last 6 games in domes. The only, assuming you count both Arizona and Dallas as domes, the only loss being last year at Dallas in the playoffs.
In the playoffs.
Yeah. So.
I mean, Russ is going to get whatever he wants in this game.
And I think that because the Falcons being so bad in terms of pass defense will force the Seahawks into a good offensive game plan, despite the fact that they're favored in this game.
Or, I mean, how are the Falcons against the run?
They're good against the run.
Oh, well, even better.
Yeah.
That's what we're cheering for, is teams to be good against the
exactly.
run.
Exactly.
I mean, we'll see what they have to do. They're going to do what they have to do in this game. They're probably not going to blow out the Falcons. It's really not in their sort of like mindset, but could this be a 24-10 type game?
I mean, frankly, it should be similar to their games against Arizona. You know, they won that one 27-10 in week 4. This is Arizona's a better team than Atlanta.
Oh, yeah. Significantly better.
Yeah.
And obviously, Kyler presents a bit of a different skill set than Matt Schaub.
Wow, that was so diplomatic. It was me-esque.
But I think that could be a reasonable template, though. Is they go in there, they know that they're better than the Falcons at basically everything, and their offense is going to score against the Falcons. They'll get up early, they'll take a comfortable lead, maybe they'll give up some bullshit touchdowns or whatever, but like, this is going to be I think it'll be a comfortable victory.
I think so too. Chances of victory?
83%.
I'll go 80.
And they need to win. I mean, as we discussed, every game is a must-win game at this point, but this one is probably the easiest game left on the schedule.
I guess it depends how much you factor in home field, but given the possibility of rain at home, probably yes.
I mean,
there's no way it'll actually be like the highest line for the Seahawks the rest of the season.
If they announce Matt Ryan's out, that line's moving.
Maybe. We'll see.
What are the games that you think are easier? I like that we always devolve into the looking at the schedule portion of the...
Home versus Arizona, they'll have the highest line.
You think so? Who's better?
Or maybe home versus Tampa Bay.
Yeah.
One of those two. But both of those will probably be higher line than this. Because people just don't know that Bruce Arians is at CenturyLink Field.
Dear God.
All right. On that note.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.